I think when you ignore the market dynamics and ignore what the market can tell you about these things, you do so at your peril, and you're inviting unanticipated consequences that could be worse than the problem you're trying to solve.
Hi, I'm Dan Hayes with Reason TV. Today we are joined by author Rob Salkowitz, the author most recently of Young World Rising: How Youth, Technology, and Entrepreneurship Are Changing the World from the Bottom Up. Rob is also a business consultant and contributor to the website Fast Company. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, great to be here.
Can you define the term young world and give us an overview, sort of the broad argument of what your book is about?
Sure. Of the 6.7 billion people on Earth right now, more than half of them are under the age of 30. And the largest number of those live in underdeveloped countries for the most part, or emerging economies like India and China. As we move toward mid-century, the difference between the aging developed world and the young developing world is going to accentuate. And I see a lot of possibilities for discovery of talent in this young world.
Mm-hmm. And so these folks who have grown up with this technology, that's part of the argument, is folks have grown up with this technology, they're used to it, and they're using it in their everyday lives, as opposed to that older generation who's not.
Sure, and we've seen that here in the U.S. and in other industrialized countries over the last 25 years, because, you know, we're at the front edge of this stuff, so we're the frog that's been boiling in the tank. Elsewhere in the world, a lot of these technologies are not only relatively newly arrived, but they're arrived at a much farther state of development. And younger people are taking to social networks, to mobile communication, to these new technologies that have been so disruptive here in the U.S., in really interesting ways in these younger parts of the world. And as technology access increases, driven partly by market forces, I think we're going to see that dynamic accelerate.
You start the book with a story of a young guy named Suhas Gopinath in Bangalore, India. What is his story, and how is it sort of representative of your argument in this book?
So Suhas is great. He was 14 years old, young kid in Bangalore from a humble background. And he started working after school at a cyber cafe, taught himself to do web development, and started a business for himself creating websites for businesses in the U.S., particularly small manufacturers that had an email address but no website. So he would email these folks and say, "I'm Mr. Gopinath from India. I'd like to order 10,000 of your widgets. Please direct me to your website." And they would say, "Well, we don't have a website, but we have a catalog." And he'd say, "I'm sorry, you don't meet my supply standards. By the way, would you like to buy a website?" And, you know, it sounds a little shady, but he is now studied in Indian marketing programs for the ingenuity of this plan. He's grown his company into a global company. He's in 12 different countries. It's a multi-million dollar concern. And he is the youngest member of the World Economic Forum. So he's sipping champagne in Davos with Bill Clinton and Warren Buffett.
But he started as a 14-year-old in a cyber cafe, basically.
And he's only 22 now, and he's looking for the next thing to do because, you know, he's done with that.
Yeah, that's incredible. So you said you'd like to look particularly at the unique relationship between youth, technology, adoption, and the willingness to take entrepreneurial risk. So what is the relationship there?
Well, there's a couple of things. One thing is that the spread of technology, and particularly high-tech business models, are much less capital intensive. So you can start a business the way Suhas did with almost no investment except your own expertise, because you've already got the platform to reach a global market, to tap a global talent base. So that sort of changes the economics a little bit, makes the entry costs a lot lower. And also the rewards are higher, because for the people that have the talent to do this, especially in developing countries, it's like, you know, you don't have to work in the T-shirt factory, you don't have to work in the mine. You know, if you can figure this out, you can earn a decent living for yourself in, you know, dignified working conditions and give employment to other people and sort of move society forward in, you know, better in different ways.
And that's if you have access to the technology that allows that to happen.
Absolutely. Not just the technology, but also the skills and know-how.
In the book, you suggest that this young world is more adept at figuring out market-based solutions to social problems. So can you kind of talk about this idea of social entrepreneurship and how that's addressed in the book?
Sure. It's kind of an interesting concept, because here in the U.S. and in industrial economies, we have these concepts of social entrepreneurship, which is, you know, grant-funded, nonprofit that's trying to do good in the world. And then there's corporate social responsibility, which is a commercial business that's putting their own, you know, out of the goodness of their heart, trying to solve a problem. Elsewhere in the world, the idea of commercial prosperity can't be separated from social progress. And let me give you an example. Like in India, Infosys, the enormously successful IT services company there, spends a huge amount of money training young people, even graduates of good schools, to get them up to this level of global employability that they would have, that they need to be effectively competitive. But they don't stop at just the elite institutions. They actually deliberately broaden their search because they know that there's a social impact of picking some kid out of a small rural college, you know, as one of the chosen few that's going to get to work at Infosys, goes back home, becomes an ambassador for knowledge economy, becomes an ambassador for entrepreneurship. And the VP of Infosys said to me, if we stop doing that, if we narrow that search for talent and cut off that access to opportunity, the whole India story is over. And she said the India story, not the Infosys story. And, you know, because Infosys sees its role in the Indian economy in broader terms than just its own prosperity, and it recognizes that if it can't deploy its own resources to make progress on these issues, its commercial success as a private business is in peril.
You seem optimistic about technology in general and technology in the future. What's your grand sort of utopian vision going forward? In 20 years, what are we going to be doing that we can't do now?
Well, I would say technology utopianism isn't my orientation. I'm actually rather pessimistic about the general direction of things, and I look at technology as the only way we're going to solve these problems because there's a real deficit of public will to address common challenges right now. So our best hope is to, by broadening a conversation out to a billion people, makes it more likely that we're going to find that one in a billion idea because that's the one we need.
So talk a little bit about your politics. You've kind of argued that there's a top-down, hierarchical, sort of archaic system in place and that this young world is going to provide a bottom-up, you know, way of exchanging information. Can you kind of talk about, that sounds a little libertarian, can you kind of talk about your personal politics and the politics of this book?
Yeah, I mean, I think that large organizations serve the 20th century pretty well. And because centralized hierarchies were a good way of organizing large organizations to get stuff done. So move into the 21st century and these networks start to offer us other options about how to manage organizations, organizations that can be a little bit more nimble, that can be a little bit more responsive to the local needs and local cultures and local desires of the people that are doing them. So you're not forcing people a choice between, you know, you either take the big solution or no solution. You know, we can actually customize. And so I think that is not only, you know, a good way to run a business, it's a good way to solve social problems. And I do feel deeply that there are these social problems. We have a common responsibility to fix them, but we need to look at market-based mechanisms for making those solutions happen in ways that are relevant to real people.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned before you're more of a progressive guy, but you look for these market-based solutions to solve the problems.
I think when you ignore the market dynamics and ignore what the market can tell you about these things, you do so at your peril and you're inviting unanticipated consequences that could be worse than the problem you're trying to solve. At the same time, if you only pay attention to the mechanism and not to the larger issue of what is it we're trying to do, what outcomes we're trying to produce, you know, you create a very efficient road to nowhere. So we have to get beyond that dichotomy because our problems are too big for that kind of thinking.
So lastly, why should somebody read this book?
If you're a young entrepreneur, you're going to find some really great ideas, some really inspiring stories of people that are making great solutions out of almost nothing. If you're a business leader, you really need to understand what's going on in these parts of the world. Emerging markets are where the growth are. Or where the growth is, and there's a lot of opportunities to engage with these young world partners and to understand the sources of young world competition before it arrives at our shores.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Rob. I enjoyed talking with you.
Pleasure.
If you want to learn more about Rob's book, visit youngworldrising.com. And for Reason TV, I'm Dan Hayes.